supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Today's show is about talking to our teens about sex and sexuality. Let's be honest. Many of us, parents, hope that our teen sex education class will cover this topic for us and we'll be off the hook. Really? Let's listen to a clip from The Simpsons. Bart's teacher, Mrs. Crabapple, takes on sex ed.
Class, in order to explain why your hormones will soon make you an easy target for every smooth-talking Lothario with his own car and tight jeans, I will now show a short sex education film. Ezekiel and Ishmael, in accordance with your parents' wishes, you may step out into the hall and pray for our souls.
Hello, I'm actor Troy McClure. I'm here to provide the facts about sex in a frank and straightforward manner. And now here's Fuzzy Bunny's guide to you-know-what. This is Fuzzy Bunny. About a year ago, he noticed his voice was changing. He had terrible acne and had fur where there was no fur before. He also noticed Fluffy Bunny.
Boring.
All right, so you know what makes this clip so funny. What makes it funny is that that's a variation on what most of us have had in sex ed and probably what many children are still getting in sex ed. They're still hearing about Fuzzy Bunny. Well, that is, unless you had a sex ed teacher like Al Vernacchio. Al is our guest today here in the studio. And in addition to teaching a course in human sexuality at Friends Central here in Philadelphia, he's also written for Goodness Sex. Al, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'd love to hear from you today. Please call in and call in early. I have a feeling we're going to get a lot of calls. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I want to hear if you're concerned about what to tell your children or what to ask them, or if you'd like to know about, we'd like to know about your own sex education. Where did you learn what you're about to teach to your children? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. So, looking at your book, Al, when we talk to our children about sex, it's a similar conversation that we have with them about drugs, something you call the disaster model. Like, if you do this, something horrible is going to happen. And that's the sex ed talk.
That is. And that's the problem, is that we start from a place of sexuality being something dark or sinful or wild or something that's uncontrollable. And I would propose that we start from a point of sexuality being a really great gift and one of the best things about being human and one of the most important ways we connect to other people. If we start with sexuality as good, it's a lot easier to have the conversations.
You kept the same root, but you switched the meaning of the word when you went from sex to sexuality. What's the difference, teacher?
Well, actually, that's how we start my class, is asking students to define what they mean when they hear the word sexuality. And most often kids will say it's either some version of sexual activity or some version of sexual orientation who we're attracted to. Mm-hmm. But sexuality is much bigger than that. It's really the way that our own gender and sexual orientation influence how we are in the world. And if you think about it, the way we identify our gender as male or female or some other gender identification, when we think about our romantic and sexual attractions, that really influences not just what we do with our sweethearts in a bedroom, but it influences everything we do every day. So sexuality is much bigger than just what we're doing when we're having sexual activity.
So what's the experience of being a sexual being?
Well, it starts from our earliest moments of life. And, you know, the initial, Erickson said, the initial task we have to figure out is basic trust versus mistrust in the world as infants. And being held by our parents and being loved and having that experience of touch and the pleasure that comes from the softness of a skin, that's all a sexual experience. It's not sexual activity. But, you know, breastfeeding is a sexual experience, and holding kids and rocking them in our arms is a sexual experience. That's how we begin to learn about our bodies and about pleasure and about relationships.
Well, Papa Freud almost got thrown out of Vienna when he talked about sexuality in infancy.
He did. Although I think, you know, we really are sexual beings from birth to death. And if we deny that reality, I think that's why parents have such difficulties in talking with their kids often, because they don't want to see their children as sexual beings. But they are. And there are developmentally appropriate ways we can talk to kids at every age. And we can talk to adults at every age, including older adults.
Speaking of older adults, when my late father was in his 80s after my mother passed away, he was quite the bon vivant. I mean, he went from a conservative, emotionally conservative guy, and he was dating three women at once, and it was great. He called them by different food groups because he couldn't remember their names, you know, sweetie pie and lamb chop. Anyway, he calls me one night because I'm his only male surviving friend, and he says, "Danny," he says, "I got to second base with Esther last night." And I thought, oh my God. I said, "Dad, I don't even want to know what second base is. I'm just imagining it sags closer to home plate. I don't want to know." But you say you don't like this baseball metaphor.
That's right, I don't. The baseball metaphor is sort of the classic American metaphor we have for sex. And if we start to examine it, you realize it's very problematic. Baseball is a competitive sport where there are winners and losers. Baseball is a sport that has a very strict order of play that you're not supposed to deviate from. Baseball requires a certain skill set and a certain level of athleticism and physical fitness. And all of those things set up sexual activity as goal-directed and competitive and not really about being in the moment with our sweetheart, enjoying what's happening and figuring out together what's going to happen. Rather, we play by this set of prescribed rules. And that's just not good for us.
It's also sexist. It's homophobic. It's all those things. I have to tell you that, you know, I make jokes about how when I was in seventh grade, I got to third base with, and she shall remain nameless, on Delavan Avenue in the beach in Margate. And I will never forget that moment. But it was years later, and I wondered what it was like for her when I got to third base. What was her experience like? And as I got older, I wondered, what was the experience really like for me? It was an accomplishment. It was almost a rite of passage. And I don't want to rule those rites of passage out as being all of them irrelevant, but what was it like for her?
Right. And that's, you know, we don't want to rule out those rites of passage. They're incredibly important developmental steps, but the way we talk about them and the way we label them is really significant in creating healthier, unhealthy sexuality going forward. As you said, one of the things we have to do a better job helping kids think about is that when they're in a sexual experience, there's another person there. And if that person's needs and pleasure and wants and desires are not equally as important as our own, what kind of interaction and relationship are we creating? You know, sex has to be about social justice. It has to be about equity. It has to be about expanding our sense of our authentic selves and sharing those authentic selves with somebody else. Third base doesn't do that.
That's a lot to ask of a 14-year-old kid.
It is.
They don't have a sense of other, really. or the internal structure of other.
Right. So we start in smaller and developmental ways. I mean, one of the things 14-year-olds can understand is, are you using a person like an object? And so in a sexual interaction, if you're realizing that this person is only a tool for your own sense of self or satisfaction or pleasure, that's problematic. And I think kids can understand that.
Yeah, they sure can. Let's go to the phones. We've got Rob on the line. Hey, Rob.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm a pastor at a local church, and one of the things I do is lead the youth group. We had a three-week series on sex and sexuality recently. And one of the things that I said to these kids is that they have a more difficult prospect for them than most teenagers through most of human history. And that's because we as a society have moved, we've increased the gap between when they are interested in having sex and when we as a society and their parents say it's appropriate for them to have sex. So for most of human history, puberty and the marriage age were fairly close together, and that over the last 100 years or so, that gap has just ballooned to now probably 13 or 14 years from when they're 14 years old and they want to have sex, maybe younger than that, to when they have finished high school, finished college, gotten a graduate degree, settled into a career, gotten married, and now we as their parents say, now it's appropriate to have sex. And I think that we as a society are still wrestling with what to do with that gap with all of these 18-year-olds that really want to have sex, but we're telling them that they can't. And I wonder if your guest has any wisdom for me as far as how we can address that huge chunk of their life that suddenly is there that wasn't there in previous centuries.
That is a great question. And thanks for the call. And Al, I like the way Rob use the word wrestling with. Mm-hmm. And man, if you're going to wrestle with something, that's integrity.
You Absolutely.
Know, that's honesty rather than proclamations.
Right.
But
go on. Rob's absolutely right. The differences in the age of puberty today from 100 years ago are startling. And, you know, when you hit puberty at 13 or 14 and you got married at 16, it made a lot of sense to say, okay, if you can just wait for a couple of years, you'll have the full range of adult experiences open to you. But when puberty starts at 8 or 9, you know, and the age of marriage gets later and later, 26, 27, it's really hard to say to kids, if you can just wait for 14 or 15 years, you'll have the whole range of adult sexual experiences. So the question that I think we have to ask is, what is an appropriate way for a 16, an 18, a 20-year-old today to express their very natural desires, need for pleasure. And so we can say, and I think often what happens is parents get very nervous that it's either, you know, everything or nothing. And I think that's not true. I think we can talk to kids about what are ways that we can seek and share pleasure that are in intercourse, that don't put you at great risk for unwanted consequences, but that can also fulfill some of these desires for closeness and connection.
I had a conversation with my grandson, who is just finishing middle school now. And of course, my research for this show got me thinking. And he and I had a long talk, and he said the words, three words, "I'm not ready." And I thought it was beautiful that he knew that he was able to talk about the experience of that. And, of course, I encouraged him to please stay in touch with that. But as he gets into high school, freshman, sophomore, junior year, there's going to be pressure on him, you know, from peers and from the larger culture. And this is an age where kids want to fit in. They want to be like the other kids.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things we have to be really intentional about is helping kids realize that a lot of the media messages and a lot of the pressure they're getting is actually a lot of talk and hype, and that there are lots of kids who aren't ready, and that these are decisions that we have to make based on our own sense of ourselves and our own sense of our values. And if we simply adopt someone else's behavior because we think that's what's expected of us, that's unlikely to lead to a great experience.
So you go from baseball to pizza, and I get these are two things I enjoy more than anything. But
yeah, me too. So, you know, when the baseball model clearly wasn't working, and this was long ago in my early career as a sex educator, I thought there's got to be a better model. We've got to find something that that people will respond to positively, but that will give a whole different set of expectations for the way sexual activity can work. And I don't remember when I hit on pizza, but I know that when I hit on it, that was it. And if you think about having pizza or sharing pizza with somebody, the first thing is that it actually starts from an internal desire. You have a hunger, and you get to decide, am I going to satisfy that hunger? Am I going to not? There's a decision process there, but it comes from a natural human response. The second thing is pizza is not competitive. It's cooperative. You're sharing an experience with somebody, and you're interested in that person. And then before you have pizza with somebody, you always talk about it. You talk about what you want and what you like, and you can even negotiate. And then, of course, when we're having pizza with somebody, the goal, if there is any, is just to be satisfied. And that's a moving target. That can be different on different days or with different people, or even with the same person at different times. If those were the expectations that we gave our young people about the way sexual activity could work, that it is internally driven, that it is cooperative rather than competitive, that it's about satisfaction that can be achieved in any number of ways, not just by rounding the bases, we'd have a generation of kids with much healthier sexuality and much healthier outlooks about themselves.
Al, there's one thing in what you said that I really want to pursue, because I want to see if it's realistic, what you've said. You said with pizza we talk about what we want and what we don't want and what gives us pleasure and what doesn't. I'm guessing 95% or more of all adults have never had that conversation with their partner. So is it realistic for kids to do that?
I think it is. The adults haven't had the conversations because they haven't been told that those conversations are necessary, normal, appropriate, good for us, or at least they weren't told that when they were teenagers. My whole idea is if we can start talking to kids at younger and younger ages and we can give them clearer expectations and clearer ideas about how to navigate this, that they will grow up thinking that this is perfectly normal. And I know that kids who have gone through my classes, it has changed their idea and their expectations about relationships. And they're sort of startled when people they're talking with don't want to talk about these kind of things.
We've got to take a break now. When we come back, though, I want to talk with you about parents, parental anxiety, you know, how we've had no role models, and, you know, our fear of our own impulses, let alone our children. And then we'll talk more about your classes. We're talking to our children about sex and sexuality. My guest is Al Vernacchio, and he's the author of For Goodness Sex. He's a sexuality educator and an English teacher at Friends Central. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I promise we'll get to more of your calls in the second segment, but we'd love to know your experience. What were you taught? And what, in turn, did you teach? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Devereaux, one of the leaders in behavioral health care, helps to provide care for children and adolescents with mental health challenges, as well as individuals of all ages living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Across its national network, Devereaux helps provide meaningful care to individuals and families where they need it most. Whether it be through community and educational programs, employment services, foster care assistance, or individual or group living support. Learn more at devereaux.org.
On the next Fresh Air, race relations north of the Mason-Dixon line. Historian Jason Sokol says while many in the Northeast looked with scorn at the racism of the Jim Crow South, there was racial violence, discrimination, and segregation in their own communities. Sokol is the author of All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family with Al Vernacchio, author of For Goodness Sex, and that's what we're talking about. What do we tell our children? What have we told our children, and what will we tell them about sex? More important, their own sexuality, sensuality, and relational justice and fairness. I got a smile from Al when I said that. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Al, I want to talk about us poor parents. You know, we are the primary educators here. But, I mean, we've got our own conflicts about sex. And the vast majority of us have had no role models at all. I mean, I love to tell the story about I was 13 years old, and I'm laying in bed, and all of a sudden my bedroom door opens, and I see a hand slip through the door with a paperback book in his little grasp. And he flips the book over to the bed, and the hand quick comes back, and the door slams. And it was Facts of Life and Love for Teenagers, yes, which taught many chapters about masturbation, mm-hmm, and how often. And so And we never had a conversation after that. So that was my sex ed. But I think that's a variation on a theme for many of us.
It was certainly my sex ed growing up. I grew up in an Italian-American, Roman Catholic, working-class family in South Philadelphia. And my parents weren't comfortable talking about sex, didn't know how to do it. When my mom sat me down, she talked to me about the Marriage Act, and how the Marriage Act was a really beautiful thing, and I was probably curious about the Marriage Act, and I should ask her if I had questions. And of course, the question I most wanted to ask is, what's the Marriage Act?
What is it? Yeah.
So I really appreciate the fact that parents feel out of their depth here. And I think that part of the answer to that is that what parents can do with their kids and for their kids is actually not, they don't have to have all the answers. What they need to provide is context and a system of values that sort of give kids a way to think about their bodies.
How do we find our own values? That never gets explored. And, you know, I said before, afraid of our own impulses. I mean, we've been afraid of our impulses, I don't know, since we could speak, sure, since we could write. I mean, it's all over the Ten Commandments. It's all over most religions.
Sure.
We're scared of ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And unless we get the chance to sort of critically examine that and to ask ourselves, why do we believe what we believe? And I guess the other thing I would say to parents, which is really key when they're thinking about their children, I mean, I have no doubt that and I'm not a parent myself, so I can't speak from this perspective personally, but I've taught thousands of kids and met thousands of parents in my time as a sexuality educator. And of course, they all love their kids and want the best. But when it comes to sexuality, they deviate in one important way. Most times when parents think about their kids, they think about their hopes for their kids. When it comes to sex, they think about their fears. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I ask parents to do is to encourage their hopes and not their fears. When you think about your child as a sexual being, what do you hope that will look like? And most parents, of course, want their kids to be in loving, stable, fun, sexy relationships. So the question is, if that's where we want to get, how do we start today? What's the step we take today to help kids move in that direction?
I want to talk about one dimension of that. Fathers and daughters, mm-hmm, and mothers and sons. And I saw that my daughters were sexual beings, and they were beautiful women when they went through, you know, puberty. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I knew they were sexual. And You know, I told them, I said, I want you to enjoy sex and sexuality, and I want you to do it right after my funeral. And so, I'm making fun of myself with them, but, you know, there's a kernel of truth in that. It's really hard to do. That, you know, a colleague of mine coined a term called counter-incest, so that we tend to withdraw from our opposite sex children for fear of our own feelings about them.
Right. And I think that's, you know, and then let's think about our both parents and our kids who are not heterosexual. And does that dynamic change in those circumstances? Sure. And again, I think, of course, a lot of times we notice when kids are going through puberty or in their young adulthood, how incredibly beautiful they are and that they are sexual beings. If we started that process earlier, if we noticed it earlier and saw this as a continuation of a process, we'd have a lot easier time talking than if we suddenly realize it.
So what do we do here? How do we manage our own anxiety about, you know, our children, not just their sexuality, but their sexual choice, their sexual orientation? And then there's the whole bigger world about texting and sexting and social media. These are worlds we didn't know about.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, so parents need, you know, they need help and they need guidance. That's part of why I wrote the book. But I think parents can talk to each other. I think parents can reflect on their own experiences growing up and think about what worked and what might be different and how they might want to do it differently. And I think parents should really feel free to talk to those of us who are sexuality educators. We'd love to be a resource for them. I always tell parents that, you know, you're always welcome in my class or to give me a call because I, you know, if your pipes break and you don't know what to do, you call a plumber. And I'm a sexuality educator, so I'm happy to be a person who can be a resource. But as you said earlier, parents really are and need to be the primary sexuality educators of our kids.
It's a pretty funky metaphor there, comparing yourself to a plumber. I mean, never mind.
Yeah, don't let's, go there.
let's go to the phones. We've got Lori on the phone. Hi, Lori.
Hi there. Thank you both for this conversation.
Sure.
So I have a mixture of like laughing as well as like fear coming up. First, I wanted to share the story of how my mother approached me. I don't know. I never actually asked my sister how she approached her. I just know my sister stayed in her room for 3 days after she found out about sex because she was horrified that my parents were going to have done something like that, so to speak. But my mother approached me. I was in fifth grade. She handed me a book. And it was when I grew up I was born in 59, so this is in the 60s. And there was those booklets in the doctor's offices, and she had gotten one of them. And, you know, years later, because I was thinking back, you know, to how she approached us, and it was I read through the whole book, and when I look back now, it was a book on reproduction, but it wasn't mentioning sex anywhere, or, you know, how the sperm got to the egg. And I remember going down after I read it like five times, I was trying to figure out, well, how does the sperm get to the egg? It doesn't tell me how a baby's made, you know? And I walked down. I didn't even go and sit next to her. That's how like far away we were from this conversation. I walked down the stairs about halfway until I could see her in the living room. Dad wasn't around. I looked in and said, Mom, I've read this book, you know, five times, but I still don't understand how the sperm gets the egg and how a baby's born. And she turned gray. Didn't say a thing. And in my awareness, I went, wow, she's not going to be able to answer that. And I said, I'll go back and read it again. She walked back upstairs, and that was it. That was our conversation. That was that was it. There wasn't anything.
Lori, do you have children?
Yeah, well, that was one of the reasons I'm writing now is I'm a late bloomer, and we adopted a little girl. So at 54, I have a 5-year-old. And so I'm wondering if, you know, the resources in this book for goodness sex they're fabulous. Just to start sooner, it seems like it's an approach for just life and relationships.
This is
and adding in our sexuality, which is it's just a beautiful approach. So I'm wondering, do you have any suggestions for me starting now? And we've had some conversation, but
Yeah, we do have suggestions, and I strongly encourage you to buy the book. It's really, really great. But let's hear what Al's suggestions are.
Sure. I think that when we're talking about kids who are 5 years old, there's a really simple rubric that I use that another sexuality educator, Danny Horn, invented, which is that with little ones, we want to talk about love, families, and fairness. So in terms of love, we want to talk about the idea that everybody deserves to have a sweetheart, that having somebody who's special to you is really important, that that person could be a boy or a girl, but that everybody deserves that. We want to talk about the fact that there's all different kinds of families, and families are people who come together and love one another and want to support one another. And we talk about fairness, that nobody gets to be teased or judged because of who their family is or who they are or what gender they are or things like that. I would add to that, it's important to teach five-year-olds the proper names for their body parts, to start helping them understand that their bodies are good, that pleasure is not a problem, that it's actually a really great potential that we have, and to also, even at five, start to help them look at the world and see the different messages they're getting around their gender or around their sexual orientation, if they can identify it that early, and be able to tell them what's most important is what you feel inside, not what people are telling you from the outside.
What do you tell a five-year-old? What kind of conversation?
Well, I would say to a five-year-old, what are the kind of things that do you notice any difference in the kind of things that boys and girls do at school, maybe at recess, or the way boys and girls are different at school? And they can usually identify some of those things. And then we can talk about, well, if we're talking to a little boy, well, do you think you could go and play with the dolls or with the tea set if you wanted to? And gauge their answer and then say, well, of course you could if that's what you wanted to do. So just beginning to sort of show them that their own yearnings and natural inclinations are more important than something outside.
I also trust that kids are still playing doctor.
Absolutely.
At that age.
Absolutely. And that, you know, and that we tell them that it's very exciting to look at other people's naked bodies, and that that's a private activity, and that is something that, you know, we don't do with grown-ups, for example, except for, you know, mom. You know, the good touch, bad touch is a whole different conversation.
Right, right.
But what I want them to know at five is that being curious about their body is fine, that it's natural, that there are ways to explore that curiosity, and that I'm not going to get mad at you if I come upon you touching your genitals, or if I come upon you with a playmate and, you know, you're playing doctor.
So what do you do if, you know, you come across your son, let's say, and spends an awful lot of time with his hand on his penis?
Yep. Well, we would say that is we understand that feels good, that we understand it's a great way to sort of soothe himself. He probably can't understand that language, but it's a way to make himself feel good and feel better. But that's a private behavior, and it's something we do in our house or in our bedroom or in our bathroom. It's not something we do in public. It's not something we do at school. Mm. And it's not that we don't do it there because it's bad. We don't do it there because it can make other people uncomfortable, and we don't want to do that. We want to not make other people feel bad feelings. So by doing that privately, we can make sure we can have that, but also not interfere with other people and their feelings.
We are going to take a short break. We've got lots of callers. We do our very best to get to all of them, ideally. When we come back, you're doing some interesting stuff in the classroom, and I want to talk about that. We're talking with Al Vernacchio. He's the author of For Goodness Sex. He's a sexuality educator at Friends Central in Wynwood. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation offers services that make coping with death and taxes a little easier. The Foundation manages the legacies of individuals from Ben Franklin to Luther Vandross. It can assist you, too, with estate planning so that you may have an enduring philanthropic impact. You also may receive ongoing tax deductions for sustaining southeastern Pennsylvania nonprofits. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
The latest healthcare developments.
How what happens in Washington affects you.
How world events affect us all.
The news continues throughout your day. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are your co-hosts for Here and Now. Breaking news, thoughtful analysis, surprising interviews in the middle of your day.
With voices from all across the country so you won't miss a thing.
That's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb talking with Al Vernacchio, sex educator par excellence, author of For Goodness Sex. You like that par excellence?
I did, business. Thanks.
Sorry. Our number is 888-477-9499. So I want to talk a little bit about what goes on in your classroom. I love the example you gave in your book about how you divided your high school seniors into four groups, divided by gender, and then divided them by reasons to have sex and not to. So it's interesting because it really takes critical judgment and rights and wrongs out of the formula.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's an activity that I do every year, and we compare the results from year to year. And when you ask young people, what are some of the reasons why people their age would and would not want to engage in sexual activity? And I define that as oral sex or intercourse activities. The reasons are really interesting and sometimes shocking and sometimes really different by gender. And to realize that for many young women, reasons why they would not engage in sex are more about fear of pregnancy or STDs, and that rarely comes up on the top five in the boys' lists.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at that and being able to talk about that, the whole class is really designed to help young people have these conversations and engage with these topics, not so much to give them a set of answers, but to help them figure out, why do I do what I do? Why do I believe what I believe? Is that going to take me where I want to go?
You talked about, I'm going to forget your language here, Al, about a sexuality profile. Am I getting it right? Even a family?
Oh, a family philosophy of sexuality.
You.
Yeah. And I think that, again, one of the things that parents can do that is so important is to talk with their children at whatever age they are and whatever developmentally way is appropriate about what we believe as a family about sexual activity, about bodies, about pleasure, about all these things, so that when kids are making decisions, if they don't have a really firm sense of their own set of values, for example, they have a guideline that they know comes from people who care about them and love them that they can consider and use in those situations.
You know, when I was a student in family therapy, my mentor was running a family therapy session, and there was a 13-year-old girl in there who'd never heard anything from her parents, and the whole family was there. And they talked about their anxiety and discomfort. And my mentor said, well, would you like me to do it? And the girl said she wanted to, and he talked about it in the way one would in the early 70s. But he talked about, and at the end, he said, by the way, every step feels really, really good. And that's something we don't talk about when we talk about sexuality. And by the way, I have that same conversation with my children about drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I talk about drugs, by the way, it feels really, really good. You have to know the whole story.
Absolutely. And what I think when it comes to sex and pleasure, one of the things I would hope we could do is Let our kids know that there are so many ways to access that good and pleasurable feeling. There are so many ways we can experience connection and passion and sex. Well, I mean, I think if you want intimacy, I think taking a nap with somebody is so much more intimate than having sex with them, being able to fall asleep in somebody's arms. But if you actually want to express closeness to somebody in a sexual way, you don't have to have intercourse with them. That's one way of expressing that. But there are lots of other ways that we can interact with each other's bodies that feel great and actually might even feel better than intercourse. And I think I'll tell this really quickly. I just had an experience where I asked the kids in my class, I asked boys to make a list of questions that they always wanted to ask girls and vice versa. It's a little heterosexist, but it works in our gender unit. And one of the things boys always want to ask girls is, like, what are the kind of sexual things you like, you know, for those that have any kind of sexual experience? And the boys are always dumbfounded when intercourse doesn't come up on the girls' list because they think that's the be-all and end-all. Right. And to realize that women aren't necessarily saying that's the great thing is really instructive and important.
There was a show, I guess it's still around, called Defending the Caveman. Mm-hmm. And he said that, you know how many erogenous zones women have, and I forget how many, right, but it was double digits. And you said, you know how many erogenous zones men have? One.
Yeah.
So, you know, that speaks volumes. And again, that's funny because there's truth in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. We've got Sally on the line. Hi, Sally.
Hi, this is Sally. I have two kids who both had not particularly good experiences with their family doctors and discussions about sex. And many, many, many high school kids go and have sports physicals once a year. And it would seem to me that would be an ideal time for the physician to bring up lifestyle questions, drugs, smoking, and sex, and that he could be a neutral person. He or she would be a neutral person to ask factual questions about sex and birth control is necessary, or just a lot of just questions about sexuality, which they might not be comfortable asking parents or whoever, ministers or whoever else, that there shouldn't be any like moral judgment there. And yet I would say that with my own children, this never happened. And is there a role for the family physician and sports physicals?
Before we go to the expert, the clinician here has a couple of questions for you, Sally. You talked about the physician as being objective and not having moral judgment. So do you have moral judgment?
No, I would say that in my case, I wanted my kids to get fat. What happened was my son went to a physician when he was 16, and her question was, do you use a condom when you have sex? And his reaction was, whoa, I have never had sex. And it was a dinner table conversation that we had. 3 years later, my daughter, who was 16, went for her sports physical expecting that question. A different doctor. The question never came up. Sex never came up. And when she left her physical, she said to me, the doctor never asked me about having sex. Does he think I'm so ugly that I wouldn't have had sex by the time I was 16? And neither one of them had had sex by the time they were 16. But my thought is, if they were interested, I would like them to have somebody who they could ask questions of, not be fearful, and get straight answers about it.
And not you.
If they came to me, fine. But if they had a hesitation, I'd be happy to have them ask someone else.
Okay.
But I think that, in fact, I told the second physician, that I thought he was negligent in his duties for not bringing it up and not saying, do you have any questions about this?
All right. I'll turn to the expert. Let's hear what he has to say.
I mean, I think it would be amazing if medical professionals were part of this process. The sad fact is that medical professionals get very little training in human sexuality of any kind in medical school. They are not trained to ask the questions. They're not trained often, even with the most up-to-date information, they come in with all their own judgments and preconceptions. And so very often it depends entirely on who that medical professional is and their own background and experience. Yeah, it would be great if they could be involved in the process. They have a role to play. I would say that it's down the line in terms of, you know, parents and then classroom educators, and but certainly part of the process. We just don't train them well enough to do that.
Hmm. Thanks so much for your call, Sally. Let's go back to the phones. We'll take another caller. We've got Raphael on the line. Hey, Raphael.
Hello. So this is a really great episode, and I think the guy that you have on is really moving things in the right direction. I just feel like sex ed at this point is kind of a joke. Like the writer Dan Savage compared us, said if we taught driver's ed like we do sex ed, we would just learn about the mechanics of the internal combustion engine and then never learn how to actually drive. And when we don't teach kids about sex, then we just leave them to pop culture and media, which doesn't send any good messages. We send them over to porn, which is, you know, acting and a whole production. It's not real sex. And then we send them to their friends who also don't know. So we're kind of leaving a lot of people in the woods in terms of how to navigate this landscape. And especially nowadays with issues of consent and all these other things popping up, I feel like it's, you know, more important than ever for parents to go through their own journey and the whole rigmarole of like figuring themselves out and being comfortable talking to their kids about this.
Thanks so much for your call. Let's hear what Al has to say. And Al, I want to piggyback on something Raphael just said. It's important for parents to go through their own journey. What are your feelings about parents going through their own journey with their kids, kind of as a family?
Actually, that's a tremendous way that this can work. And one of the things that we can think about is that this is a way where kids can really be resources for their parents and can actually be helpful in the process. You know, a kid's job is not to parent their parent, but having these conversations together helps the parents in their own journeys as it helps the kids. So if we wait until everybody is, you know, totally ready and skilled and knowledgeable, we'll never talk to each other because we're never there. It's always a process. So entering into that process together is terrific. The other thing I want to react to just really quickly is Raphael talked about the fact that a lot of sex ed is a joke. And I really hear that. And, you know, part of the reason is that we still have lots of people in schools who are not trained as sexuality educators teaching sex ed. And we need to do a better job of getting people who are specifically trained in this field into classes like health and phys ed and other places so that kids can get really good expert information from trained professionals.
There's really good training out there, too. We should say that to all teachers and school administrators who were listening. Listen, Al, teen pregnancy is down.
Yes.
And are STDs down?
Yes.
They are. Why do you think this is happening?
I think partly because of HIV and AIDS, and we have really this is a generation that has grown up assuming that sexual activity is always safer sexual activity. And so condoms are a matter of fact for this generation as opposed to earlier generations. I think that because of the internet, kids have a lot more access to basic information that they didn't have before. I may not always be right, but there's a lot of good stuff out there on the net. And so kids are getting more accurate information and getting information about avoiding negative consequences that they want to avoid. I think those are two really important pieces of this.
You said kids, mm-hmm. all kids. And I wonder about, you know, is teen pregnancy down or STDs down in economically depressed communities?
No, it very much varies by community, and certainly things like poverty have a huge impact on things like teenage pregnancy and STD rates. You know, kids, people who don't have their most fundamental needs met and secure are much more likely to take risks than people who do. And so, you know, this is why sex is a social justice issue for me, that we have to address not only equity in terms of, you know, gender and sexual orientation and relationship style, but also in terms of making sure people have equal access to information and services and skills. And we're not doing that.
So you teach sex ed at a friend school.
Yes.
An upscale, pretty expensive tuition, private school in Wynwood. How would you teach this course in an economically depressed urban community here in Philly or Camden?
Sure. Well, I think that any good educator starts by asking who are my students and what do they need and what have they been given to this point. So perhaps if I were teaching this class in a city high school, I might need to focus a little more on maybe it is negotiation skills. Maybe it is looking at culture and how culture influences our beliefs and values about sexuality. But I think it would really the questions my students are asking me, I bet are the same questions that any kid would ask me. You know, how do I know if I'm ready for sex? How do I know if somebody likes me? How do I feel better about my body? These are pretty universals that our kids are facing. Because, you know, adolescence, it's all about figuring out who you are and are you normal.
Kids are not going to raise their hands in a heterosexual classroom and ask these questions.
No, of course. And so you create activities and you create different ways to help kids talk about the issues. And you also set some really clear ground rules that they don't have to reveal anything about themselves. That's not, you know, it's not Oprah. It's a class. So we're looking for information and skills. That's what education is about for me.
You know, I threw out words like the internet and sexting, and our kids are going to tell us that's normal and everybody does it. Well, is it? And is it okay? I mean, how do you know? This is, we've never been there before,
right? And that's been the biggest game changer in sex ed in the last 15 or 20 years is the advent of social media and the internet and texting and sexting and internet pornography. And you're right, we as adults don't have a lot of experience with this. But I think the conversations we can have with kids are about things like what is privacy and what does that mean? And how does that connect to our use of social media and texting?
So much more
yes.
to talk about. I'm so grateful that you came out for the work you're doing, and I'd love to have you back.
I'd love to be
especially
back.
Especially when we're talking about sexuality across the lifespan.
You bet.
We're going to do that. So we've been talking with Al Vernacchio, and he's written for Goodness Sex. He's got a blog of the same name on psychologytoday.com. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And email us at voices@whyy.org. Hey, check out my webpage at drdangottlieb.com. I got some new activities going on, new course I'm teaching. Take a look. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Lindsay Corfagno is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Here and now.